The following talk was given by Mary Sullivan at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 13, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everyone. It's really nice to see you all. So this morning, by the way, it's the day after David's and my 33rd wedding anniversary. And yes, it is possible. Anyway, I'm kidding. Or not. So what I'm going to do is I ran across this quote in Alan Watts's The Way of Zen. This is a Dharma Field Library book. I'm really bad at checking them out and then not returning them. So I've had this book for a long time, and it's a quality paperback book club. Remember that? And it's got three of his works in it: The Wisdom of Insecurity, The Way of Zen, and Tao, The Watercourse Way. So I've read most or all of The Wisdom of Insecurity on Steve's recommendation, Steve Hagen's recommendation, and it's pretty good. I've read not a lot of either The Way of Zen or Tao, The Watercourse Way. However, from time to time, just thumbing through the book and reading it random from it, I run across gems, and this is one of them. I just stumbled upon it in The Way of Zen. So Alan Watts, I want to say a little bit about Alan Watts. He's an interesting guy. According to his brief biography on the back cover of the book, was born in 1915 in Chislehurst, England. He became interested in Buddhism and other Oriental studies as a teenager and joined the Buddhist Society in London at the age of 15. After failing to win a scholarship to Oxford, his interest in Eastern philosophy intensified. And in 1935, he published the first of many of his books, The Spirit of Zen. In 1938, Watts moved to the United States and began studying for the priesthood. He was ordained in the Episcopal Church in 1944. He continued to read about Zen, however, and began to see that his success in the church as a teacher and counselor had much to do with his, quote, infusion of Christian forms with Buddhist and Taoist meanings. Quote, I saw increasingly that those ideas were much more intelligible to the laity. Watts left the church in 1950. And began to popularize the concepts of Zen, becoming a cult figure when it became part of the popular culture during the Beat era. He ran encounter groups in his later years and continued to lecture and write. So I don't think that does his writings justice. He does have an interesting introduction to this anthology entitled Beat Zen, Square Zen, and Zen, which is very interesting, but not germane at this time. So I was very interested to realize that the U.S. Episcopal Church has always been part of the worldwide Anglican Communion, as it's called, tied to the Church of England. However, U.S. Episcopalians are generally liberal on matters of sexuality, marriage, and the role of women, not so the Anglican Communion. But we're not going there. This is a topic for another time. So it would not be inaccurate to describe Alan Watts as having been an Anglican minister before he left the church. So to return to the quote, this is a quote by Bang Ke. I think I'm pronouncing this correctly. B-A-N-K-E-I. According to Wikipedia, my go-to source, he is Bunkei Gyotaku, born 1622, died 1693. He was a Japanese Rinzai Zen master and the abbot, interestingly enough, of Ryomonji and Nyohoji. He is best known for his talks on the unborn, with a capital U, as he called it. According to a man named Colin Oliver, he adhered to no particular school, and his teaching was remarkably individual and raw, of the essence of Zen. His concern was with truth as an immediate experience, not a systematic approach to a distant goal. So this is Colin Oliver. There are many interesting stories about Bunkei that I've run across. He was born into a samurai family. His father, who was a Confucian, died when he was young. At an early age, he became concerned about death. There are parallels here with the young Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, such as the fact of being born into the warrior or samurai class, becoming concerned about death at an early age. And, quote, by Colin, his tantrums could be quieted by mention of death. Frequent quarrels with his elder brother caused him to become so frustrated and depressed that he attempted suicide. He swallowed a large number of spiders, which he thought were poisonous, and then sat in a shrine awaiting his death. When nothing happened, he decided to give up suicide. As a young adolescent, he went to study Chinese with a teacher, and while studying a Confucian classic, he was forcibly struck by a passage stating that the way of great learning was to make clear the, quote, bright, with a capital B, virtue, with a capital V. Puzzled, he questioned a number of Confucian scholars who admitted to having no deep knowledge. In disappointment, he turned to the Buddhists, attended their sermons and discourses, and reported back to his mother. The Buddhists also disappointed him. He was determined, however, to enlighten his mother as to the meaning of bright virtue before she died. At last, he decided to search for a Zen master. The Zen master instructed him in the practice of Zazen in order to gain direct knowledge of bright virtue. Bunkei approached Zazen with his characteristic determination. He sat cross-legged in a cave for hours on end and did not eat for a week. Apart from his falling over with exhaustion, nothing happened. In a hut in his village, he tried reciting the Nembutsu. This is the Pure Land practice of chanting the name of Amitabha Buddha over and over. Despite the appearance of sores, and they don't say where, he refused to relax, but remained sitting with pads beneath him. He continued this life of meditation for a long time, and eventually he sickened himself. Again, parallels with the historical Buddha's life-endangering practices of asceticism are noteworthy. His friends became concerned and provided him with a servant to care for him. He thought he was dying, and his one regret was that the problem of the bright virtue remained unsolved. Then, on the verge of death, Bunkei came to the realization that he had never been born. He saw into the illuminating source of all things, by which all things are well managed. I like that. It reminds me of what Norm says about how all beings support each other. Bunkei was convinced that he could live from the unborn, capital U. It was a totally life-changing insight. This ability, this belief, this faith in living from the unborn. He felt immediately revitalized, and he asked his astonished servant to prepare him a meal. When he was fully recovered, he went to his mother and told her of his discovery. He wanted her to die happy. He was so disconcerted by the difficulty he then experienced finding a master to confirm his insight that after finding one who encouraged him, he decided to devote his life to helping others by sharing the truth. That's another interesting parallel with another Zen master, the sixth patriarch, Huineng, who after hearing one line from the Diamond Sutra and waking up, realizing he went to look for a teacher. So now, finally, at long last, we come to the quote. So a layman asked Bang Kei, I appreciate very much your instruction about the unborn, but by force of habit, second thoughts keep tending to arise. And being confused by them, it is difficult to be in perfect accord with the unborn. How am I to trust it entirely? I think that's a great question, and one we explicitly or implicitly ask ourselves all the time. How do I trust reality with a capital R? In what can I truly put my trust? Actually, the question itself points to the answer. And we may or may not return to that. Also, I want to quote something Norm said last Sunday in response to a question that Jordan asked him. It had to do with confusion and big mind. Norm said, strictly speaking, there is no confusion. This is precisely one way to point to the unborn. So Bang Kei answers the layman, if you make an attempt to stop the second thoughts which arise, then the mind which does the stopping and the mind which is stopped become divided, and there is no occasion for peace of mind. So it is best for you simply to understand that originally there is no possibility of control by second thoughts. Let me say this again. So it is best for you simply to understand that originally there is no possibility of control by second thoughts. Yet, because of karmic affinity, through what you see and what you hear, these thoughts arise and vanish temporarily, but or and are without substance. Then he says, then Bang Kei says, brushing off thoughts which arise is just like washing off blood with blood. We remain impure because of being washed with blood, even when the blood that was first there was gone. And if we continue in this way, the impurity never departs. Here I would like to substitute the words disturbance of mind for impurity. As the Xin Qing Ming says, we disturb our original peace of mind to no purpose. And Bang Kei goes on, this is from ignorance of the mind's unborn, unvanishing, and unconfused nature. So I want to read the whole thing again. Brushing off thoughts which arise is just like washing off blood with blood. We remain impure because of being washed with blood, even when the blood that was first there has gone. And if we continue in this way, the impurity never departs. This is from ignorance of the mind's unborn, unvanishing, and unconfused nature. So this is mind with a capital M. Bang Kei goes on, if we take second thought for an effective reality, we keep going on and on around the wheel of birth and death. You should realize that such thought is just a temporary mental construction and not try to hold on to or reject it. Let it alone, just as it occurs and just as it ceases. It is like an image reflected in a mirror. The mirror is clear and reflects anything that comes before it, yet no image sticks in the mirror. The Buddha mind, the real unborn mind, is 10,000 times more clear than a mirror and more inexpressibly marvelous. In its light, all such thoughts vanish without a trace. If you put your trust in this way of understanding, however strongly such thoughts may arise, they do no harm, meaning they do not stick, they vanish, they are empty. And actually, he's not trying to be reassuring here. He's just pointing to the action of the whole, of totality. Isn't it interesting, though? He speaks of the minds, mind with a capital M, unborn, unvanishing, and unconfused nature as trustworthy. This is trustworthy. Unborn, meaning not arising, not dependent upon conditions. Unvanishing, meaning, as Steve says, it is always thus. He also quotes Katagiri as saying, here it is. What is it? This is the unvanishing quality of mind. Steve also says, obviously, this is not nothing. So Steve is pointing to this unvanishing quality of the unborn, or mind with a capital M. In physics, this is symmetry, that which is invariant, unchanging, always showing up as thus. Yet earlier, Bankei says, yet because of karmic affinity, through what you see and what you hear, meaning just our everyday experiences, these thoughts arise and vanish temporarily, but are without substance. So there's a contrast here between the unvanishing and the vanishing. And this is directly observable, this arising and vanishing. This is what we observe when we sit in Zazen. There is no contradiction or duality here. This is just pointing to experience. I like the reference to unconfused nature. As Norm pointed out last week, casually tossing it out as an aside, or so it seemed. Strictly speaking, there is no confusion. This is the nature of mind. This is a very subtle point, actually, that Norm is making. It doesn't say a lot, but it says everything. Confusion arises, or seems to arise, dependent on conditions. Like the washing away of blood with blood, or the attempt to get rid of what Bankei calls second thoughts by trying to stop them. What Norm is pointing to is that this is totally unnecessary, because fundamentally the mind is not confused. As Bankei says, so it is best for you to understand that there is no possibility of control by second thoughts. He says, you should just realize that such thought is just a temporary mental construction. A temporary mental construction. It forms, but if we don't pursue it or try to get rid of it by thinking about something else or turning our attention away from it, then it is temporary. It is temporary anyway, whether we do this or not. We just distract ourselves with more temporary mental constructions and fail to see that they vanish of their own accord. I really do love what he says here. So it is best for you to understand that there is no possibility of control by second thoughts. You should just realize that such thought is just a temporary mental construction and not try to hold on to it or reject it. Let it alone, just as it occurs and just as it ceases. Suzuki Roshi says the same thing. Let it come in and let it go out. This is not easy. So now we come to why I decided to talk about this in the first place. I read this entire quote from Bankei to David, my husband, for those of you who don't know, starting with the question from the lay practitioner. David then asked me, in a way that I took as challenging, the validity of what I just said, dependent upon how I answered the question, can you do that? All I could hear at that moment was his mother's voice saying, in a somewhat sneering, superior way, can you do that? This is a good time for me to repeat that yesterday David and I celebrated our 33rd wedding anniversary. So it is possible to hear one's mother-in-law's voice in one's husband's voice, sneering at one, and still remain married. All righty. Anyway, I thought actually fairly quickly before I could lose my temper entirely, given my very short fuse these days, that it is really, really a good question. That is because, in part, an answer suddenly popped into my mind. No, I can't do that at all. In fact, as soon as I enters this picture, as soon as a self or ego or sense of accomplishment or sense of separation from the experience or a sense of doubt or discouragement or failure arises, letting go or realizing that second thoughts are just temporary mental constructions becomes more difficult. That is when, as Bankei says, there is trying to wash away blood with blood. It just can't be done. After all, what is the I but a temporary mental construction itself? As soon as you really try to find it or look for it in immediate direct experience, it vanishes. The I is just that image reflected in the mirror. It does not stick. So as I contemplated this talk a day or so ago, and I've been thinking about this talk for a while now, but this line just came to me a day or so ago. A line from Dogen's Genjo Koan came to mind. Dogen says, to study the self is to forget the self. To study the self, this is big self with a capital S. As Suzuki says, self with a capital S, meaning wholeness, totality. As Steve has been pointing out, excuse me one second. As Steve has been pointing out in his teachings on Dogen's Busho, Dogen uses the word study in unique ways. So here Dogen is saying, as Bankei is saying, just see the nature of mind. Just be awake to experience. Be aware to here and now experience. And even that is too much because it is still dualistic. So Norm says, be awake, be aware. This is to study the self with a capital S. This is Zazen. This is what Yaka-san is pointing to when he tells his teacher, Sekito, who asks him, what is it you are not doing? And Yaka-san says, even Buddhists don't know, or even Buddhists can't say. He is just sitting, letting temporary mental construction alone, just as it occurs and just as it ceases. So Dogen says, to study the self is to forget the self. The second self is self with a lowercase s, a small s self, as Steve says. To see, to be awake and aware, to see mental constructions as they are, is to forget the self with a little s. It is letting go of temporary mental construction. It is to realize that small as self is empty, is non-abiding. Pay attention to experience. Try to find small as self or locate it somewhere, anywhere in your experience. Or locate it somewhere, anywhere in your experience, and it vanishes. Again, I think I'm going to pause here for questions or comments.
Mary, we have a question from Shirley.
Okay.
Wondering if you could explain what second thought is as opposed to first thought.
I was afraid somebody would ask that question. So my understanding of second thought is when after thought, actually, there's an answer to that question I'm coming to, but I will answer this directly. As thoughts arise and we notice them, there is this tendency to return to them and maybe scold ourselves for having them in the first place, or to start to elaborate on them, or they lead to a chain of thought. So a mental construction arises, and then we notice that. But then it's hard to let go of. It's hard to, as Suzuki says, just let it come in and let it go out. So second thought is sort of our tendency to invite those thoughts into tea, as Suzuki has said. So those are second thoughts. The initial thoughts give rise to thoughts after that, that then we tend to get pulled by. And that's not to say there's anything wrong with that, there's anything bad about that. That's just what happens. And so awakeness, awareness, return to that. Be awake, come back to awakeness, awareness. But as he says, with regard to the washing away of blood with blood, he's talking about getting caught up in those second thoughts in ways that are critical of or judgmental of the thought in the first place. Does that help at all?
She does have a follow-up question. She says, ditto on second self versus first self.
Did I say second self and first self? I don't think I said that. I don't remember talking about, I talked about big self. So I'm talking about in the quote, to study the self is to forget the self. So the first self is big as self, wholeness, totality, reality. So sitting in zazen is to study the self. To forget the self, that's little s, small s, self, ego self. Again, empty. No big deal. But what studying or sitting or being awake, being aware allows us to do is just notice the insubstantial, non-substantial nature of small s self. Is that clear?
Yes.
Oh, good. All right. I'm going to go on. So, Alan Watts quotes Wang Po after this. He says, Alan says, this is also the doctrine of Wang Po, who says, again, and doctrine is not really a good word, so this is the Wang Po quote. If it is held that there is something to be realized or attained apart from mind, capital M, and thereupon mind, little m, is used to seek it, that implies failure to understand that mind and the object of his search, of its search are one. Mind cannot be used to seek something from mind. or even after the passage of millions of kalpas, the day of success would never come. So, to put it in Bunke's terms, as Bunke said to the layman, if you make an attempt to stop the second thoughts which arise, then the mind which does the stopping and the mind which is stopped become divided, and there is no occasion for peace of mind. So this mind is the one mind. This is just the activity of the one mind. I know. A kalpa, by the way, refers to an inconceivably long period of time. Norm is a genius at talking about kalpas, and I'm not going to try to go there. It has to do with, I don't know, a goddess coming down once every, I don't know how often, and throwing her gauze-like cloak over a rock, and then taking off, coming back in 100 years, doing it again. So a kalpa is maybe the length of time it takes for the gauzy filament-like cloak to wear away the rock. So really, we're talking a long time. Anyway, as Wang Po starts out in his masterpiece, which I can't think of the name of, there is nothing but the one mind. There's nothing but the one mind. As Norm says, and this one mind, this is boundless, limitless, all-inclusive reality. There's nothing outside of it, so it cannot be sought or attained or experienced in any way separate from what is being experienced right here and right now. So, with great trepidation, I'm going to pause and ask a question. Let me read the Wang Po quote again, actually. If it is held that there is something to be realized or attained apart from mind, and there, that's mind with a capital M, and thereupon mind, little m, or little s self, small s self, is used to seek it, which is the only way we could seek it, by that separation, by that division into small self, and little mind, that implies failure to understand that mind and the object of its search, are one. That mind and the object of its search are one. Mind cannot be used to seek something from mind. For even after the passage of millions of kalpas, the day of success would never come. Any questions or comments? I will do my best. I make no promises.
Mary, I don't know if I'm going back to what you said earlier or not, but you were talking about to study the self, capital S, is to forget the self, small s. And would you say then that studying the self is through zazen, or how would you say studying the self, capital S, and that also in the mind?
As Steve pointed out in his Busho class, Dogen has very special ways of using the word study. But what he means is, what I understand him to mean, is that to study the self is just paying full attention, being fully awake to, fully present with experience. And even that is dualistic. Anything I say about this is dualistic. That's why Norm just cuts through all of that and says, be awake, be aware, because then there's no separation there. There's no separation between the studying and the self, the wholeness, totality, reality. And so when there is that separation there, when we become preoccupied with these mental constructions, then there's that division that Huang Po is talking about. When he says, trying to attain something apart from mind, and thereupon using little mind to seek it. That's a failure to understand that mind and the object of a search are one. So these are really not separate. And Dogen is saying, he's pointing directly to that, the lack of separation there when he says, to study the self, to see, really see totality, wholeness, is to forget the self, then those dualities no longer exist. We can see that they're flimsy, they're non-substantial. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Good.
Thank you. So, since I have a little more time, I'm going to give you one more quote, since I never ever go to the full end of the time. So this is a quote somebody emailed me day before yesterday. This is a friend. Outside of this, outside of Dharma Field, but a person very interested in practice and all different kinds of expression of practice. So this quote is from, I'm going to massacre the first name, Chagdud, Chagdud, Tulku Rinpoche. This is a Tibetan Vajrayana master. Nyingma, that's one of the lineages in the Tibetan system. A Tulku refers to the Tibetan idea that this Lama is a reincarnation of a previous Lama with his name. And per Wikipedia, Chagdud Tulku Rinpoche, by the way, Rinpoche is like saying Roshi. It's an expression of respect. Per Wikipedia, he was a Tibetan teacher of the Nyingma school of Vajrayana Tibetan Buddhism. He was known and respected in the West for his teachings, for his melodic chanting voice, and for his skill as a physician. Interestingly, his dates are 1930 to 2002. And I think if you go on the web, you can actually hear some of his recordings. Of his chanting, and I bet they're beautiful. So he says, this is his quote, to understand how delusion arises, practice watching your mind. Begin by simply letting it relax, without thinking of the past or future, without feeling hope or fear about this thing or that. Let it rest comfortably. Open and natural. In this space of mind, there is no problem, no suffering. Then something catches your attention, an image, a sound, a smell. Your mind splits into inner and outer, self or other. By the way, your is misleading. So in light of everything I say, let me get rid of that your and just say, mind splits into inner and outer, self and other, subject and object. In simply perceiving, there is still no problem. But when you zero in on it, you notice that it's big or small, white or black, square or circular, and then you make a judgment. For example, whether it's pretty or ugly. Having made that judgment, you react to it. You decide you like it or don't like it. That's when the problem starts, because I like it leads to I want it. We want to possess what we perceive to be desirable. Similarly, I don't like it leads to I don't want it. If we don't want it, but can't keep it away, again, we suffer. Our suffering seems to occur because of the object of our desire or aversion, but that's not really so. It happens because the mind, with a capital, and not even, I can't even say the mind splits. He's just talking about this experience. It happens because it seems the mind splits into subject-object duality and becomes involved in wanting or not wanting something. So this is he's talking really about one of the 12-fold links in the chain, one of the links in the chain of 12-fold causation. And he's also sort of talking about that karmic affinity that Benkei spoke of in his quote, "Yet because of karmic affinity, through what you see and what you hear, these thoughts arise and vanish temporarily, but are without substance." So this karmic affinity is what actually why certain things may catch our attention, but maybe not the attention of the person sitting next to us, say. Anyway, so with this splitting of mind into inner and outer, or as Huang Po says, that there is something to be realized or attained apart from mind, and thereupon mind or smallest self is used to seek it. That implies failure to understand that mind and the object of his search are one. I'm sorry if this is not clear. I don't know that Chogdud Tulku Rinpoche took it quite that far, but he is talking about this process of second mind, of this getting caught up in the duality of once the object has formed, and not seeing that really it vanishes if we just leave it alone. We reach out for it. We want it. We make a judgment about whether we like or whether we dislike it. And with that judgment, there is wanting, craving, and with that comes grasping. And as I said when I was talking in my class, just seeing that, just seeing any one of those links, the formation of the mental construct, the splitting of experience into subject and object, of then wanting, of craving, of grasping, any one of those links, just seeing any one of those, seeing through any one of those, and the entire entire mass of suffering dissolves. Anyway, the Xin Qing Ming says the same thing. The Xin Qing Ming says, seeking mind with discriminating mind, capital M mind, seeking mind, capital M mind, with discriminating mind. So there's that split that we see as what happens, but is really an illusion. Is not this the greatest mistake? So this discriminating mind is the mind Chogdud Rinpoche is pointing to here, the mind that starts to make judgments to which there is the reaction of either liking it and wanting it or not liking it and rejecting it. This is a discriminating mind, and this leads to suffering. Now, we want to call that confusion, but ultimately, as Norm pointed out, there is no confusion. Otherwise, there would be no dissolution of the 12-fold chain of causation. Anyway, Chogdud also says, our suffering seems to occur because of the object of our desire or aversion. But that's not really so. A very important point. He goes on, it happens because the mind splits into object-subject duality and becomes involved in wanting or not wanting something. Banke notes that the antidote to this is just to see that these are temporary mental constructions. They are empty of illusory substance. Well, it's 10:48 and I at least got past the 10:45 mark, which I usually don't do. Any questions? Comments?
Shirley has a follow-up question, and she wonders if you could just clarify the difference when you're talking about a word with a capital letter and with a small letter, like when you're talking about self or mind.
Okay. So, I take these distinctions for granted, and maybe they shouldn't be. So, self with a capital S, mind with a capital M, these are conveniences. These are pointing to that which really cannot be spoken of, but we try anyway, we do anyway. And they refer just to this, totality, wholeness, reality. I know, we hear this all the time, but I think we fail to realize that this is just pointing to something that's pointing to that which is boundless, limitless, undivided, all-encompassing. What can I say? The more I say it, I'm worried about confusing people the more I talk. But I think that's when we, conventionally, that's what we mean. When we talk about big S self, self with a capital S, mind with a capital M. There is nothing but the one mind, nothing outside of it, nothing to compare it with, nothing to accept or reject because it's not divided up. It's all inclusive. Nothing is excluded, as the Xin Jing Ming says. So typically when we talk about the working of consciousness, we're talking about, and I want to refer you to Steve's new book. He's got two appendices that deal with this very thing in the Grand Delusion. Our tendency to divide up reality, but it's illusory. It's an illusory division, but it's based on, seeing this versus that, opposing something and something else, assuming separation where there is none, assuming limits where there are none, because that's what conceptualizing does. I don't know. Shirley, does that help at all? Oh, good. All righty. Thank you, Shirley. Anything else? Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.